any other students that are science oriented?
Oh, there were some. I can remember Garrity and Jorgensen and people like that, UP, but they were people that, I guess the, we really never built up very lasting relationships in the time that I was there. Got along well with them all, as far as I was concerned, but when the school closed, everybody pretty much went their own way. In fact, I don't think I've ever heard or seen of a person from Jordan College since then, except, of course, my brother was a graduate and amongst, he was one of the first graduates from that school, and he has still kept in contact with two or three people from that period, but I never did.
Now, your associate's degree was in chemical engineering.
Just in chemistry, yeah.
Oh, okay. I have a note here. It was in chemical engineering, and that's what I...
No, it was chemistry. Because
okay.
We had, as far as people, you know, knowing chem engineering at that school, we didn't. Flanagan knew pretty much classical organic chemistry and a little bit of what he had learned in the industrial laboratories at the time, so... And he knew inorganic chemistry, too. So that was pretty much the type of thing. He knew biology and taught that. And he did teach a course in comparative anatomy, too. So,
based on his experience with the Ford laboratories and natural polymers, did he give you any exposure to that?
Well, he gave very elementary pictures on polymers, and that maybe I would go back and see maybe one or two rather elementary lectures at the latter stages of the organic chemistry class. People do very, when you can stop to think of it, see, it's, what is it, 1928 or so that was Staudinger who really was identifying the chain nature of polymer molecules by his dibenzene work. And people prior to that, they knew something about properties of rubber and natural polymers, but I don't think they had much of a comprehension about the real chemistry and what that was involved.
The school closed in 1939?
It closed in 1939. I finished 2 full years there.
But it wasn't until April of 1940 that you came down to Midland. What did you do in the intervening period?
Well, what I ended up doing was going to work in the sawmill, and I had been spending some time trying to get accepted at other schools, and it was becoming quite apparent to me that wasn't going to work out.
Let's go back then to Dow. We've described your interview, and did you start the next day then, or did you?
I went back. That afternoon, I got my physical and went over to the lab. So I was the next day. I was ready. I was ready to go to work, and did go to work. In fact,
many of the people that came in at that time went through that student training program. Did you go through that?
No, that's, see, I was hired in at an hourly rate.
I see.
They had the, well, of course, the Dow had not been hiring much for several years at that point, and it was just things were just starting to come back. And I was hired in, they had various hourly classification in the lab, starting with where the bottom was lab helper, and that's where I was, you know. So they had lab helper, and then you took a series of examinations and that were generally prepared by the technical professionals in the lab, and you went through lab assistant and senior lab assistant, laboratory technician, and senior laboratory technician. So there were about five classifications. I remember starting out, though, for 64 cents an hour as the but I'll tell you something funny. A friend of mine, Neil Marshall, came from the University of California at the same time I did, and he came with a master's in physics. Do you know how much his salary worked out to? 80 cents an hour. That's right. Neil didn't stay at Dow. He worked there for, probably a year and left. I never heard from him after that. But I remember us comparing notes about what a master's degree was worth over an associate's at the time. Worth 16 cents an hour. Isn't that something? But you see, the senior lab technician, you could get up to, maybe 90 cents an hour. So you could get above entry level for a master's degree in physics or chemistry at that time.
There were a number of people that joined the physics lab at that time. I want to have a list of them.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe we can talk about some of them later.
Mm-hmm.
What was your first assignment?
My first assignment was, I became involved with the styrene. Styrene was being produced over at 323 building and was being sold to the Bakelite division of Carbide. They were the only manufacturers of polystyrene, and in fact, it was the only customer for styrene that we had at the time. But what we used to do is analyze for aldehydes, peroxides, residual sulfur, polymer content, and so forth. See, so I had the job of following through on making sure that all those analyses were done and watching for the quality control. The physics lab was still tightly associated with it at that time. Then the other job that most of my time went to was concerned with the light and heat stability of Saran, and as we called it at that time, Vetiloy. That was the even best. Ralph Wiley had been working on Saran, and of course had the problems on light and heat stability were already identified as the key problems for that material. And there were two fellows, of course, who tackled that problem. One was Lauren Matheson, who you probably have heard of by this time, and the other was Ray Boyer. And they had developed techniques to measure the light and heat stability. One of them, of course, involved dissolving what they called Vetiloy C, which was a vanillidine chloride 15% ethyl acrylate copolymer in dioxane, and in these little vials there was an Edisonian research program, but people really didn't know how you would light stabilize a polymer. They knew it was photodegradation. They had pieces of film that they'd exposed to various wavelengths and measured the rate of color development, but how to prevent it they really didn't know. But Ray and Matty, they were really both physicists. Matty was from the University of Michigan, and of course Ray from Case, and so they did know something about optics and all. In fact, Ray had built a circuit where the null-type circuit and just using a simple potentiometer and a couple of photocells, the standard, you know, you could measure the light absorption at 3650 and detect the yellowing. I remember Ray's apparatus very, very clearly at that point, because what we do is cast these lacquers onto little glass tabs and then expose them for different periods in a fadometer and also outside, and then simply measure the decrease in transmission at 3650 as an indication of yellowness. So I had that job, and then there was another technique that was rather interesting for the light stability. Rather for the heat stability, they'd take a mag plate that was about a foot long and maybe about 4 or 5 inches wide, and they'd drill holes in it. The mag was nice because, you know, it was nice polished metallic surface. And what we do is cast these test samples in these holes. We had them identified, and we had these sample boxes that held 100 vials. We made a very neat thing to make these all up, you know, and put them on a tumbling stir, get the solutions, and then dump them into these little pits that were drilled in. They were about a half-inch hole. It was drilled about a half-inch deep. You'd pour the lacquer in there, let it dry, so now you had a nice film in there. You could go ahead and subject this plate to different heat treatments, and from your blanks and all, you could pick up whether you had something that was stabilizing or whether catalyzing degradation. But that was the techniques that were used, and so I had worked on that problem. That was primarily all an Edisonian research program that was initiated by Boyer and Matheson, and I was really indeed a lab helper doing it for them. That was all there was to it. I certainly wasn't creating the solutions, but I was learning what the hell was going on. So, and then of course I worked with Ray when Ray was, they were doing the, trying to identify the types of chromophores that you got when the HCl split off of Saran. So I was doing the work with morpholine and doing the dehydrochlorination and the four experiments for them, and this provided the database that Boyer used for publishing some of his paper back at that time on the development of conjugated sequences in dehydrochlorinated polymers. But those were specifically Boyer's ideas at the time, and they identified things like the 2,2 prime dihydroxybenzophenone as a good light screen and for Saran, and then there were quite a number of other compounds. Salo was one of them that also worked, but not as good. But you know, I noticed the benzophenone derivatives are still used today in marine varnishes and everything. I don't know if you're aware of that, but that really was a very key thing at that point in time as far as Saran was concerned. And I think that Ray and Matheson really were the real pioneers in making that kind of a development. But all the while, I was fortunate because I was, you know, I was in really with people who were very smart. Polymer science was in its embryonic stages, but these people were very competent, multidisciplinary group of people, and certainly most willing to, if any neophyte was curious enough, they were willing to pretty much take you under their arm and help you. See, that's what I found out about that old physics lab. There was, and go right up and down the hall, and today, you know, every one of them that that was there. I could name them, what they did, what their work was, and because I was, tell you the truth, I was a real sponge. The whole thing interested me so much that that I learned very, I think, quite thoroughly what every one of them did. But it was a very well-staffed lab at that time. Not only did it have a lot of good professionals, it had a lot of good people to, if you wanted to start development of a new product, you could count on a good engineering department that was under, well, Porter Hart went to Texas early in that, at that time. You read about him in the book on pioneers. He was in the engineering department. Warman Barstow was there, you know, and there was Joe Frank. My goodness, there were so many people that I can remember at the time. And up and down the hall, we had people like Larry Amos, of course, who was responsible for the mass polymerization. He and Ken Stover, ultimately, of styrene. Steve Stowe, who was a cracking expert. Freddie Soderquist, who was expert on cracking materials. Bobby Dreisbach, who at that time really was the inventor of styrene, of the particular styrene process that Dow used. But, I could go right up and down the line. There was, of course, Harold Robinson, who was a very good chemist, played a major role in the development of the precipitation of mag hydrate from seawater to... That was one of his major projects. Then there was Jack Chamberlain and Paul Shelley, who were doing a lot of work on acidizing wells and the Dow well development. You know, you could go right up. Well, Ray McIntyre, who played a big role in the styrofoam development, and also in the very early work on impact polystyrene. Okay, so you know, you could, Holly Hansen, who was the who had actually done a lot of work on the very early stages of using twin screw extruders in devolatilizing, but also he did a lot of work on development of the coil polymerization technique after finding out about Alfrey's QE scheme and R1, R2 values. You know, he was a guy who figured out really how to keep a constant monomer composition so that he made good constant composition copolymers, saved styrene, maleic anhydride, that sort of thing. But all up and down that hall, there was a lot of talented people. I remember having the very early days there electron microscopes. Dow got the first one. Bob Heidenreich, who ultimately went to Bell Labs, you know, was the first guy we had working on that. But the physics lab was certainly multidisciplinary, competent, inventive people. John Grebe was certainly an inspiring director, there's no doubt about it.
Did you have any interaction with Jim?
Oh, yeah.
The lab tech?
Yes, I did, yeah. It was, you know, one thing about it, once you became established, and I started doing things quite on my own, because once the war started, and the decision was made to take the Dow process, the Dreisbach process, to make styrene monomer, almost everyone in that lab started to work on some phase of the styrene process. Larry Amos was working on monomer production very intensively, and in fact, he had a pilot plant on alkylating benzene at that time, and I used to, and then of course, Bobby Dreisbach, by that time, had gone over and was trying to make divinyl benzene and a lot of styrene derivatives. Trying to make chlorostyrenes and everything else. He'd been successful with styrene. He always felt that if styrene was available for, at that time, 25, 30 cents a pound, chlorostyrene ought to be available at 10 or 50 because of the price of chlorine. But he was a fun, Bob was a fun guy, a character, but a lot of fun. So at any rate, when the war started and the decision was made for Dow to build the plants around the country, a lot of our engineers who were in the physics lab at that time went off and were the supervision, you know, for building those plants in Texas and Sarnia and California, wherever they built those units. And so we lost a lot of our engineers at that point. But we went out and we ran the pilot plants. I remember as soon as the projects got going, I ran a pilot plant for Amos, generally from 4 to 12, and I worked for Boyer from 8 to 4, so, and it was right straight through. I mean, you know, we were just working 16 hours a day for the week in and week out, and but we learned what we had to about how to operate those pilot plants and do the scale-up work. A little different than it is today. People want to scale up from the test tube to the plant without any intermediate. It's
how long of a period did this? 15-hour-a-day.
Oh, I would say for about 2 years. But then the other thing was that I had gotten quite interested in styrene polymerization myself, mainly because in connection with this very early work on light and heat stability of Saran, I was also under Boyer looking for looking how to light stabilize polystyrene. So we were doing a similar job, and I was doing a lot of ampoule polymerization with a lot of other materials, and so I had learned a fair amount of polymerization of styrene on small samples. In fact, one of the problems that I looked at was the distillation problem. Now, Sylvia Staser and Bob Dreisbach, working in the early stages of that styrene development, had of course run into the problem of a polymer formation during the distillation step, and they identified some of the inhibitors at that time. Because when I came on the scene, sulfur was the inhibitor that was being used in the distillation towers for styrene, and the tertiary butyl catechol was being used as a storage inhibitor, and those things go back to Sylvia Staser's work. So the interesting point about it was there was not too much data, though, quantitative data, on how polymerization inhibitors performed. So I had started to work on that, and I developed a method that's, in fact, is if you look at, you've seen the old styrene monograph. Now, the technique, for example, in Everett Luce's chapter that showing the dilatometer, and I used I had a device where I could focus on the capillary that came from a reservoir, And this capillary, the monomer came up into, and I just thermostated the monomer. And then I had to be able to record the drop in meniscus in this calibrated capillary. So I used an old mono drum that it was nothing more than, you know, a 6-inch drum that that rotated at variable speeds, and I'd end up putting a graph paper on it and used a follower system that I could turn this drum on, and the light beam would pass through the capillary, focus on the turning drum. In fact, I could probably show you that thing very easily. Should be Everlusis. Everlusis was head of the analytical lab at that time. Show you just how primitive some of these things were. Capillary, make a nice plot on the Rosalind paper. You could get the height. Well, that kind of led me to ultimately to do a lot of work on polymerization kinetics later on. But see, now one thing, this was only good for maybe the first 5-10% of polymerization, and then the system started to harden up and would no longer fall. But it was real good for getting the initial phases and for studying inhibitors. So in this chapter that Ray and I co-authored on, we got sections in here on catalysis of polymerization, casting bubble-free polymers, and various things like that. But on the inhibitor part, there was other studies concurrently, but all of this stuff was types of things that I did. What we also, you know, it really wasn't a real accurate type of test. It sufficed for the general behavior at that time, but we also used another technique in the modified Ostwald viscosimeter in our very early work days. Now, here it was, the interpretation was a lot more inaccurate than the shrinkage, as you might expect, because you were dealing with the molecular weight as it influenced the viscosity. So all we do is seal up these Ostwald viscosimeters with the monomer and different amounts of inhibitor, and then thermostat and right in the bath, turn it over from time to time, and then measure the rate of flow. So that's how this type of curve here, this is some of my work that was done back at that time. But we did, in the course of that, I did find the nitrophenolic inhibitors for styrene polymerization. And I think one of the funny stories about it, I maybe shouldn't tell it, but it really is funny. Because really I wasn't looking for inhibitors. It was simply the fact that in the course of doing some of that Edisonian work on looking for styrene light stabilizers, it's the fact that I had worked with some nitrophenolics, and even with small quantities, I couldn't polymerize my samples at all. So I had known by that time, I'd learned enough about inhibitors and all. I thought, gee, you know, this this seems to be far more effective than at higher concentrations, particularly than the inhibitors we're using. So, see, we had never been able to distill divinyl benzene. I used to get a kick out of Bob because Bob Dreisbach, he'd take the diethyl benzenes and he'd run them through his cracker, and of course he'd end up with some of the uncracked diethyl, but he also ended up with some ethyl vinyl, and he also got some divinyl. And it turned out he tried to separate that mixture and using a, he had about a 100-plate pod, and he'd run that thing, and all of a sudden, you know, he'd get into popcorn polymer formation and all, and he'd just bust those pods as neat as could be. See, the popcorn always expands when it polymerizes. And so, at any rate, the real funny thing was that the first patent I ever got was on the nitrophenolics. And, you know, you're really looking at the difference here. This is one of my work done, the 2-nitro-4-6-dichlor. And you notice that its inhibiting conduction period is still going along very nicely on an exponential scale when you start getting to higher concentrations. And that's not true when you start working with TBC, and sulfur is almost an order of magnitude less effective. But I remember writing a report on that work, and Bob happened to be at the at that reporting session, and he got all excited, and he went out to his distillation setup, you know, and he took the He put the nitrophenolic in there, and lo and behold, he didn't have any problem with polymerization and breaking his pot up. So